You're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, just here to let you know that this episode has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Falling in love is easy, at least that's what the songs tell us. But staying in love is harder, and forging a relationship that feels strong and fulfilling for the rest of your life, well, many people find their relationships fail that test of time. Paula Young-Eisendrath, a Worcester psychologist who's worked in the area of couples therapy for decades, says when we fall in love, we enter a state of idealization. But staying in love, staying together, requires first a disillusionment, a necessary step to a long-term stable partnership. And it's what we do in and through that disillusionment that determines the strength and contentment of our pair-bonded relationships. Young-Eisendrath's new book is called Love Between Equals, and in it she explains why she thinks modern marriages and couple relationships are harder to thrive in than ever, but she also offers her own ideas about ways to strengthen communication, commitment, and contentment. Given that love is on the minds of many today, we thought it would be a good moment to talk to her about her new book and her ideas. Paula Young-Eisendrath, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So you say it's harder than ever to thrive in a couple relationship. Why?
Well, I think we've imposed our ideals on couple relationships in a way that is really stronger than ever before. And let's just say that we'll be talking about marriage loosely as a committed long-term cohabiting relationship. And so when I say the word marriage, I don't necessarily mean legal marriage. But, you know, in the past, marriage actually functioned in some ways kind of like a corporation. People stayed together in order to raise the children, to retain the property, and to exist over generations as a family with stability. And that kind of stability often hid things like oppression, abuse, various kinds of addictions, and so on. But it worked as a kind of impersonal commitment. So women particularly who, you know, were functioning under a man's name, typically, and the children, they were dependent and they could take on the project of marriage in a kind of impersonal way. So my parents' marriage, for example, lasted a long time. They were not particularly friends, but my mother would not have thought of that as an insult or a reason to lower her self-esteem. She would think, well, it's good that I'm staying because I'm in it for all the right reasons, even if I don't like him. And I think she would have thought it would be strange to be a friend of my father. And so now we've actually put into the whole formula a lot of aspects that are very personal. For example, you know, we do believe that we should fall in love with anybody, that the person doesn't have to be the same tribe, the same race, the same social background. We should be able to fall in love with anyone that our heart fancies. And that goes against the old rules. The old rules would be you should find somebody sort of like you, so there's continuity. And then also we have imposed this ideal of equality, which I think I understand it and I appreciate it as a growth and development for individuals and maybe even eventually society. And the ideal of equality is that as partners, we're in a kind of reciprocal, mutual, there's nobody who actually can command somebody else. It's not a hierarchy. And so we're always checking, was that fair? Is this an injustice? And we have difficulty negotiating because we get in our minds this whole ideal of injustice. And then the third thing that I think is, you know, has been imposed really in the 21st century is this idea of being with somebody who functions as a kind of emotional mirror for you, someone who gets you, who feels your feelings, who sees who you are. And we have this sense that if the partner is not getting me, then I actually am being insulted by staying. So now the reasons for staying are very personal. So the old sort of vow of until death do us part is now more or less as long as this suits me. And so that kind of setup for marriage actually has imposed a lot of conditions that actually do make it difficult for individuals to stay if they feel that their self-esteem is lowered, or if they have the impression that the other person doesn't get them, those conditions can lead to both physical and mental suffering. And so in some ways, the slightly 50 plus divorce rate for first time marriages could be a sign of health that people are leaving because they're so miserable. On the other hand, looking at the function of marriage for families and stability, we're in a rough spot right here. We've made marriage more unstable by creating these conditions. And at the same time, we've created conditions that might lead to greater psychological and spiritual maturity if people can actually learn the skills that are necessary for staying in this kind of relationship. And I like to emphasize that, you know, most of us did not grow up learning these skills. And our parents and our grandparents didn't have this kind of marriage. So it's kind of rough to make that equation. And many times people feel bad about themselves because they don't measure up to that 50-year marriage. But that 50-year marriage probably wasn't mutual, reciprocal, equal. Those weren't the standards and probably didn't include that emotional mirroring and might not be with somebody who was really outside of the tribe. So here are these conditions that we've set that are really unique for marriage in the 21st century.
But what's interesting to me is that there's a lot of talk right now and other books written by psychologists who say marriage is a trap. We've put too many demands on modern marriage, and you want somebody who is a best friend, that sort of soulmate who mm-hmm. gets you, who also, you know, makes the hairs on the back of your neck tingle with excitement when you see them. You want to have that sexual chemistry all the time. And, you know, they obviously have to be a good partner in any financial arrangements that you have and a good parent, co-parent. That's a lot of pressure on a marriage, but you say you don't think we've put too many demands on modern marriage. It's that we don't know how to communicate within this kind of structure that we've created to make those marriages successful. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think that, let me just say it like this. Most of the world has not got this kind of marriage. I mean, most of the world is still in the hierarchical model, and arranged marriage is really pretty popular over a lot of the world. However, we've decided to do it differently and from a psychological point of view. So I'm a Jungian analyst, Carl Jung's school of psychoanalysis, and he said in 1925 that if we were going to fall in love as a way of getting married, that is getting into an enduring love, this was going to require some new psychological development on the part of both individuals. So, you know, falling in love is what a psychoanalyst would call an idealizing projection. And you have it when your baby is born, when you get a new house, or when you get a new partner. And it basically is the idea that this one is ideal for me. This is going to complete me. This is going to help me. This is going to whatever me, right? And so
Then you realize there's, you know, a crack in the floorboards.
That's not going to be the way it's going to go. But then you have a possibility. So that's the disillusionment. So there's this falling in love with a stranger. Then you go into disillusionment. Now, that was the case in the 20th century. I mean, people, that's the way my parents got married also. They just stayed in the Cold War of disillusionment for the rest of their lives, which is possible to do. People still do it. But if you go in the direction of actually wanting to find your best friend at home, wanting to keep that sexual relationship alive, and actually wanting to develop and grow old with that person, you have to develop some skills. And, you know, those skills, they relate to what people call mindfulness skills. They also relate to having insight about yourself. That would be sort of a psychological skill. And once you're able to develop those skills, and the book is really about developing those skills, once you're able to develop those skills, then you have to commit to using them. And partly that commitment to using skills in order to, let's say, experience and contain your own thoughts and feelings without enacting them on your partner, in And a part of that commitment is the commitment to that relationship. It's sort of like, okay, I dug this hole, and I am going to stay in this hole. And I am going to
That's a very romantic way to put it, Polly.
It's often the way people feel when they come to couples therapy. But it shouldn't be a prison. You know, it should feel like, okay, I'm staying here, and I'm going to do my growth and development with this person because I chose this person, and actually this is a good person. And frankly, the really interesting thing is that most people that come to couples therapy these days, they start out by saying, I don't trust you. And I often think, oh, somebody's had an affair, or somebody stole somebody else's money or something. It's never that. It's that emotional trust. And they recognize, I actually respect you. I like you. Maybe I even love you, but I can't stand you because I don't trust you. So it's that specific skill of learning how to look in the mirror of your beloved's eyes and see some version of yourself that's acceptable, and to offer a version back to your beloved that's good enough that that person wants to come home at night and talk to you. You know, and so that's a skill, actually, that people can learn, and they do in the kind of therapy I do, which is called dialogue therapy. And I think what happens these days that I feel maybe worst about, if I think about the landscape of love, is that people throw away, you know, very good relationships because they get to the disillusionment point. They feel that drop in self-esteem, and they feel like, I can't stay with this person. This person, my partner, is really to blame for all of the difficulties. So I'm going to have to leave and find another person. And actually, you can't do that too often, or you just find a kind of despair about love. So if you can stay and make it work, of course, it's better for so many things. It's going to be better for you in terms of your development. It's going to be better for your children because they have a stable relationship. And a lot of people don't have children. But I think in a way, it's better for society because people are learning skills about dealing with conflict with respect and having that mindful space between. And that skill can be used then in the public arena. It can be used at work. And so in that way, couple relationship can actually lead to the development of consciousness in other relationships. So, you know, I don't think we've loaded too much onto marriage, but I'm not entirely sure we can do it. You know, it's we're asking a lot right now. But I do know that most couples who come to therapy are not coming because of infidelity. They're not coming because of some other flaw. They're coming because they want to have that kind of relationship in which they can relate as equals and remain interested in each other and know each other over the years with that kind of passionate interest. And love, in some ways, is really just remaining interested and actually open to knowing the other person. It's that plus eventually really accepting the other person just as that person is. And that's where we get into even thinking about our adult children. You know, when they become equals with us, can we accept them just as they are, remain interested in them, and grow and develop with them? Or do we in some way or another say, no, I don't want to go there with you? So, you know, this skill that I'm talking about, I'm just going to call it a kind of mindful witnessing, is a skill that you can develop in a couple relationship, and then you can use it other places. And of course, you don't have to have a couple relationship to develop it. But in a couple relationship, you have to develop it. So it's a foundation. You know?
All right. So next, we're going to talk about how. How do we do that? And without, you know, the benefit of weekly therapy, how do we try to create that kind of mindfulness within ourselves and mindful witnessing? We're talking about why modern romantic partnerships often stumble, and we will be getting some ideas for tools to use in crafting a balanced relationship that's based on mutual respect and accountability and equality. Mark wrote in to say, I think part of the reason my wife and I have been happy together for 19 years, married for 15, is that we both realize that neither of us are mind readers. If we have a question, we ask the other person. If there's something we like, we tell the other person. It really helps keep the element of uncertainty and doubt out of the love equation so we can better be there for each other. Additionally, our love for each other has never been greater than it is now. One might think that at the start of a relationship, you could never love someone as much as you do at that moment. Trust me, as a couple with years and years of shared experiences, laughter, conversations, successes, and failures behind you, there's more to base your love on than when you first started. We're talking today with psychologist Polly Young Eisendrath, whose new book looks at ways to achieve that sometimes elusive goal. It's called Love Between Equals. And Polly, so we were talking about how many pressures there are on modern relationships, modern partnerships, but that what you think is we need the tools to be able to do what it is we say we want in that partnership. We want this friendship. We want this romantic relationship. We want to be equals in many cases and to have that relationship that's based on this sort of shared sense of goals and how to achieve them together, but we don't know how to do it. So what's the first step to try to achieve that sort of mindful presence, mindful listening within the relationship?
So the very first step is to recognize that this disillusionment, power struggle, sometimes repetitive conflict is going to happen. It doesn't matter who you pick. And so don't blame yourself when that starts to happen. Don't blame your relationship.
And don't blame the other person.
Don't blame your partner.
But they're the one who's doing the thing over and over.
I know. And it seems like that. And it seems like you've got the goods on them. You know, we're terrible eyewitnesses. We know that from a lot of research in psychology. And we're worst eyewitnesses when we're feeling emotionally threatened. So please don't think there's a videotape in your mind. Don't assume that your account of what's going on with your partner is the accurate account. So, you know, what Mark said when you read his comment.
Or a listener who wrote
the
in.
The listener,
yeah.
Yes, right. That, you know, it's like maintaining a friendship over time. That's kind of the way it looks when things work. And how you come to do that with somebody that you feel is intentionally hurting you because you feel this person knows me well. He knows all my trigger points, or she knows all my trigger points. And now she's actually using this against me. Don't be so sure, because often you're doing something to evoke it. Human emotions are not just expressive. They also evoke. And so often we are evoking feelings from somebody else when we don't even know what we're expressing, because we don't know, for example, how much contempt we might be feeling at that moment about something that a partner says that we feel is insulting. And so we set up a dynamic with another person that will lead towards kind of making an enemy. And that is the dynamic that serves as an obstacle to actually being interested and curious about a partner. And so what we have to keep in mind over time is that we need to stay interested. And how to do that actually is a little bit like how you stay interested in bird watching, even in bad weather. You know, you always want to go out there and see those birds again, because there might be something new. And you also have a little bit of, let's say, objectivity about yourself. You know, you dress in the right clothes, you go out no matter the circumstances. And so similarly, with your partner, you have to put yourself in the frame of mind. And some of this is practicing something like mindfulness. You have to have some ability to actually feel your own feelings and work with your own agitation. So you're going to try to contain and experience your feelings. For example, can you actually feel angry without becoming angry? Can you hear the thoughts and feelings in your own mind and not discharge them right at the beginning? And recognize, okay, this other person, like the bird, is actually different from me. So let me ask, as Mark was saying, your listener was saying, ask questions, be interested. And especially in those moments where you're feeling terribly hurt and terribly unseen, if possible, try to experience your feelings, not suppress them, not repress them, without expressing them. There's a range of what you can do with feelings. You don't have to just express or suppress. So experience your feelings, check in with yourself, take your time slowly and then try to understand. So sometimes I think simply the phrase to your partner, help me understand. Help me understand why you said that to me. Help me understand why you didn't clean the garage when you told me you would. Help me understand why you forgot to pick up our kids. You know, so each one of these things that can feel so insulting and belittling to you or to someone else actually has a different meaning to the other person. And as you go down that path together, it becomes more and more interesting. I mean, it's like once you're able to do these sort of basic skills of being able to experience your own thoughts and feelings without discharging them and remain interested in the other person, that kind of opens a doorway to something that I think is truly love. And love is this ongoing interest in something that is going to teach you about yourself. And, you know, I use bird watching, or you could use, you know, people love cars, for example, and they'll go into owning, repairing, knowing so much about cars, no matter what the sacrifice is. But they never have this feeling like, even in a bad moment, that the car is lowering their self-esteem. You know, so it's just this kind of thing that we assume when we're with another person. We make these assumptions that they're somehow seeing us accurately and doing something to us intentionally. Very often, that's not the case. We human beings, about 95% unconscious from all the research that we know about working memory. So we do a bunch of stuff, and then afterwards we think, oh. And we don't really know why we did it. We'll rationalize it. So if you know that you are fundamentally not really a great eyewitness or especially conscious of what you're doing, then you need somebody else to help you out. So help me understand. You know, it's just like a good phrase to begin with. And then try to work with your own experience and then remain interested and use the idea of loving something. You know, it's like loving the other person is like going into a world. And as you go into that world, it becomes both more familiar and more mysterious. And I remember Barack Obama said that once about Michelle Obama, that she was both more familiar and more mysterious over the years. And I thought, oh, that's exactly it. That's exactly what love is.
We got a note from Tom who says, two selfish, imperfect people who get married need to realize that it's not about their own joy. When I ask couples who are married long term and seem happy what the secret is, they all say compromise, willingness to put the other partner first and not to live for children. Life is not perfect, nor is your spouse. And listeners, I invite you to share your thoughts here as we talk about coupledom, how to make it work, how to make it not just last, but work well. And again, our number, if you'd like to share your thoughts or your questions for Paula Young Eisendrath, is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can write to Vermont Edition at vpr.org. So what about that, Polly? Do you think that Tom's right there in that idea of it's not just about you, put the other partner first?
Well, you know, I think he's right, but I think that sounds like an ideal again. And so I'm always a little careful about ideals because I think people impose those on reality. And if you're always trying to put somebody else first, honestly, that will backfire in the long run. You're going to have some point of explosion with that because you'll get resentful. So I think where you might sort of see that going is always be interested in the other person, and to recognize also this idea that he has in there, we're imperfect, highly imperfect people, both of us, and we're in an imperfect relationship, but we have to embrace it. And since the world is very imperfect anyway, it's actually a good lesson for life at every level. I like the Leonard Cohen line from Hallelujah that, you know, love is a cold and broken hallelujah. So it's a hallelujah, but it is not a picnic on the grass. And I think, again, I like it when people don't get discouraged, you know, that they are in this particular relationship. It has for them perhaps some real hurts and wounds, and yet it's always possible to push the refresh button and do this thing of becoming interested.
But what if you have a partner who, and you talked earlier about how we get in these ruts that we go back to and we say the same thing. You know, I can imagine a partnership where one person wants to learn more and the other person says, I don't want to talk. I'm angry. I don't want to talk to you. And if you say one more time, help me understand why you're mad, I'm going to scream.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you do if that idea of trying to be interested in your partner and say, you know, help me through this, tell me what's in your brain, is not the way that your partner communicates?
Well, the very first step is don't try to control your partner. I mean, don't recommend meditation retreats or psychotherapy for your partner. That is a total no-go. That just does not work. And a lot of people can't believe it, but it doesn't matter how helpful you want to be. It's not going to work.
Here, I have the solution for you, sweetheart. Here's what you need to do.
Yes, I always love that you need to go to a meditation retreat as an opening to talk to somebody. No, it doesn't work. However, it can be the case that love is on a one-way street. I mean, in the book, I talk about the streets of love. And so the two-way street is the mutual back and forth, both people growing and developing, both people really involved. And then the other one-way street is what I call cherishment. You cherish the person, but the person cannot reciprocate. Now, sometimes when you have an ill spouse or a person who has a very different kind of life experience and there really is a gap, you can practice these skills of love, but they might not be reciprocated. And so you can feel at that point a great vulnerability, but there's still an interest on your part. And where I find this in my life is with my grown children. They're not sometimes so interested in me, I've come to find out. And so, you know, I can be interested in them and actually really ask them those questions and kind of find out where they're going, but they might not reciprocate and they might not see me at all the way that I see myself. But because they're my children, I remain invested. Sometimes, again, we'll do that with our children. You know, often people say to me, gosh, these skills you're asking for, they sound impossible. But I think mothers use them all the time. You know, we contain our feelings. We remain interested in somebody who can't really reciprocate. And especially when our children are young, we don't expect them to mirror us. But, you know, as they get older, they might not. And you can still follow them. And similarly, in a partnership, there can be a feeling of some kind of grief or loss in not getting the mutual mirroring. But you can remain interested in the other person, even when they're not reciprocating. And, you know, is it right to stay in a relationship on a one-way street? I don't know. It's always an individual question.
Let's go to Meg, who's calling in from Plainfield. Hi, Meg. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Hold on. Let me get job speaker. Okay. I'm calling because one of the keys to my relationship, my wife and I got together 28 years ago when we were in our 30s, and we had both been in other relationships. And we realized that, you know, you take yourself, as your guest said, you know, you can't blame your partner for things that happen or yourself. You are who you are. Anyway, we decided 27 years ago that divorce was not an option, you know, long before we could actually get married. And that whatever came up, we were going to work on it. And you need two people who are willing to work on it to do that. But, you know, when the options are to, you know, work something through or live with that kind of awful tension for the rest of your relationship and the rest of your lives, it becomes pretty clear that, you know, you want to work on it. And then you're not thinking every time you get in a fight, oh, well, I could just leave. Mm-hmm. You know, I could get out of this.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's helped you, Meg, with your wife, that you've been able to have that feeling of like, oh, we are in this. We better make it better because I don't want to live like this.
Absolutely. You know, we both have very strong personalities and we knew it wasn't going to be a picnic, but we love each other so deeply that we have grown to love each other more in the last 28 years because we work through all of our own stuff in addition to, you know, our stuff between us by virtue of being together and being willing to stay in the relationship and work through what's going on, because most of the time what's going on isn't about your partner, it's about you. So you know, you get to work through your stuff with somebody who knows you really, really well. And it's, you know, I think too much these days, people think, well, if I have trouble in this relationship, I can just leave.
Yeah, Meg, I appreciate your thoughts and congratulations on 28 years there of working through this stuff together. And Polly, what about that? I mean, some people say maybe we should rethink our ideas of marriage, that modern marriage maybe isn't a forever thing. It's not necessarily a legal commitment, but it's a commitment for right now or for as long as it works. You know, for Meg, with her wife, they made a decision to say, no, this is forever. And that has helped them get through conflicts that if they hadn't made that commitment, might have been like, it's not worth it. Do you think that's a, I mean, how do you feel about that approach to not Meg's relationship so much, but to modern marriage and commitment?
Well, I would say, hooray. Yeah, I think the commitment piece, it has changed. In the past, it was commitment to a family over generations. Now, if you want to say it's commitment to psychological and spiritual development together, and of course, it might not always be mutual, but I think it's good to have the commitment, develop the ability to work with yourself, which is to contain and constrain yourself under some circumstances, and the real advantages of enduring love have to do with what Meg was talking about. You will be with someone who knows you well, who wakes up with you and is a witness for better or for worse every day. And that does lead, generally speaking, to development for both individuals and development of the relationship as this kind of third element that contains those individuals. So, you know, that's really a good way to think about it. On the other hand, I just want to say for people who may not feel that they can go in that direction, like straightforwardly, that marriage or any committed relationship should not feel like a prison. It should not feel like I'm staying because there's no option to leave. And so, you know, each individual really has to look at the situation and evaluate it for oneself. But I think in general, if you can stay and you are with a generally workable person, that it's better long-term for your life. There's something more about the mystery of life that's available to you if you don't have a lot of repeated loss where you feel as though you've been defeated by life, you know, and then you might not feel that love is designed for you at all. So I think that staying is generally a good direction to think about. And I also think, and this is something, again, that Meg mentioned, that many people these days, again, for some reason, are interested in open relationships. You know, I mean, when I was a young adult, that was a whole rage thing that went on, and people got into open marriages and so on. And now I've dealt in therapy with their children, and seeing that that's just generally not a good way to go. What happens in, you know, if you're having a multiple relationship is you introduce separation anxiety all the time into your relationship. And anytime you're thinking of leaving or you're threatening the bond, there's going to be more anxiety. So Meg mentioned that too. She said, we decided not to introduce other people and not to feel more anxious. We decided to try to work it out here.
We got a note from Maria who says, my partner and I got together in our very early 20s. Now it's 13 years and three kids later. I used to always freak out when we seemed too settled into mediocrity. It seemed to come in phases. Now I sort of get excited when we seem mediocre because I know that in time, weeks, maybe months, we'll suddenly somehow rediscover each other and feel like we're falling in love again.
Yes, exactly. You have wonderful listeners. They know how to do this.
Who are clearly
already
doing this whole relationship thing well.
Yes, exactly. Right.
So, you know, this is a day that people think about love. What about for people who are not currently partnered? Because this can be a really difficult day for people who want that partnership, mm-hmm. want what you're talking about, and don't feel like they have it in their lives. What work can they be doing or we be doing?
Well, you know, I would say you can follow the path of love in anything. You can fall in love with bird watching. You can fall in love with French. You can fall in love with a car. And it really means getting to know something well and then remaining interested and then accepting that otherness of whatever it is and still remaining interested. So that path of love is available for, you know, a non-partnered situation. And can you love yourself without loving something else? I don't think so. I think you have to love in order to love yourself. You have to engage. And that other, whether it's birds, is going to teach you about yourself. It's not like you get to this just looking into yourself.
Hmm. Polly Young Eisendrath is a psychologist and author. Her new book is called Love Between Equals, Relationship as a Spiritual Path. Polly, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.